Yes, welcome back to the second hour of the Dr. Future Show. We're just working on the Skype connection with Dr. Bruce Damer, and we should have him up momentarily. Meanwhile, let me give you a little bit of background on Bruce. He is a Canadian-American multidisciplinary scientist, designer, and author. He wrote Avatars, the first book on computer-generated characters in cyberspace, 20 years ago in 1997. He's a great collaborator. Bruce collaborates with teams of scientists in various fields. He's what I would call a comprehensive generalist in that he has his fascinations, his interests, and he explores them with experts in those fields and helps to create a collaborative teamwork approach to some big issues in science. One of them is the origin of life, and how the origin of life works, where life came from biologically, and another is the origins of the solar system itself. For that, he's been very interested in collecting asteroids and bringing them into our purview so that we can understand more about the origins of the very solar system itself and where it came from. Now, of course, the combination of the two is the most interesting thing.
Hi, Bruce. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, I'm on the phone.
Okay, there we are, Bruce. Yeah, I just finished giving a little introduction to you as a Canadian-American multidisciplinary scientist. I would say you're an indie scientist, too. In some ways, the tradition of 19th century science, where you study what you're interested in and you find collaborators in those areas to help add your intelligence to the group.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not institutionalized.
Right, you're not institutionalized. You don't have to work for any particular corporation or government or academic institution. You can actually play with all of them or none of them, depending on the project.
So, that's right, yep.
That's fantastic. So, Bruce, can you give us an update on as to what you've done lately? I understand you went to China, for example.
Yeah, I went around the world in November. I started in the Galapagos Islands.
The Galapagos, okay.
Standing where Charles Darwin set foot in 1835 when he worked out his theory of evolution by natural selection. And then I went around the entire globe doing talks and meetings and stuff.
Well, let's start with Galapagos. What brought you to Galapagos? Was there a scientific conference there?
I'm part of a committee that is determining whether we can hold a conference there, and we've decided to do it. So we're going to hold the meeting in Quito, Ecuador, and then take 100 people to see the giant tortoises and the finches and everything in the Galapagos as a side trip.
Mm. Now, we've all heard about the Galapagos as being a unique place for studying evolution, but what got your attention when you were there?
It was tremendously inspiring because here you have a volcanic island poking out of the ocean right next to deep vents, volcanic vents underwater, and these evolving forms because it's on the equator and you get this weird thing, you get cold currents, so you have penguins just like you'd have in Antarctica, but you have tropical birds and coffee bushes all in one place. So
wow.
It's like everything is there.
Is it a tropical weather pattern there?
Really it's warm? All of them.
It's all of them?
Yeah, all of them. So it's cold in some places and warm in others and volcanic in others and dry and wet and deep ocean and the currents just are making it very dramatic. So I can see why Darwin was just amazed by the environment.
So it has many different climates, and it's far enough away from everything else to have evolved its own ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, these tortoises are 150-year-old ancient giant tortoises, and there's no predators. There weren't predators until sailors came and took them for soup. So they just trundle along and they got very large because they don't have to run away from anything.
So what did Darwin, what was his big takeaway from the Galapagos?
It's interesting. In the very spot that I stood, he came ashore and he noticed these finches, these small birds, and visiting different islands and different parts of the island, the finches had different beak shapes. Hmm. And then he realized that it's all the same finch, but they have a slight variation, which is their shape of their beaks. Some can crack nuts. Others can poke into little holes for food. And he realized that the species is not a fixed thing. It's actually a changing thing. And then he worked out this natural selection.
So it really played a seminal role in his thinking about natural selection as a concept by being there.
It did. It sparked that. And I went actually back to my hotel room and wrote an essay for a group in Oxford because we're working on sort of in a way extending Darwin's work to the origin of life. So Darwin, toward the end of his life, wrote a letter where he thought expressed that the origin of life could have happened in a warm little pond somewhere. Hmm. And that's the work I'm doing with Dave Diemer at UCSC, is to actually show that the chemistry does work in fluctuating hot little hot spring pools. And so we're moving the origin of life field back onto land into Darwin's little ponds.
Right, right. That's where more traditionally it's assumed these days that life began in the sea.
Yeah, and it makes sense because 90%+ of the water on Earth, even back then, 4 billion years ago, was in the ocean. So they just assumed that somewhere, perhaps where there's deep vents of hot water coming up, there would be enough chemistry to work. But it turns out the chemistry of the origin of life can't work there. Because if you make something, it gets broken down by seawater. So you can never get anything made that could start life before it gets broken down.
So you're saying because it's just open water, it's just going to dilute itself really quickly, and there won't be a congealing of the necessary ingredients to promote life.
Precisely. And little ponds, if you'll notice, if the listeners are notice, if you have a rainfall, then the ponds dry down. In just a few hours, you see there's all this sort of a ring of material that's getting more and more concentrated. It could be salt, or it could be other things get concentrated in little ponds. So chemistry can actually happen and not just float away.
Well, it's such an interesting insight. And of course, after you point something like this out, it seems like it's a very credible insight. And it's almost amazing that people were looking at it so differently before. How's your theory catching on as you're presenting it out there?
Son, it's amazing because just in the last 6 months alone, and we had the cover story on Scientific American in August, and then that introduced it to the public at large.
Right.
And now we just submitted a white paper to NASA headquarters, basically bringing this whole theory together with 18 co-authors, and that could help NASA in guiding and looking for life outside of the Earth, say on Mars, because we're part of a Mars landing site selection effort now.
Is that connected, or is that only through you, though, isn't it?
Well, it's the whole team at Arizona State University.
Oh, let's talk about this after the break. We've got to go to a commercial break. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer on the Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back, Bruce. Stand by.
Yep, will do.
Hey there, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer on his research with the origin of life. And you were about to link that to looking for life on Mars, Bruce. Can you tell us about that project?
Yeah, there's a new rover, weighs about 1,600 pounds, launching in 2.5 years. It's like the current big rover there, but it's the second one looking for evidence for past life on Mars. And we're part of one of three landing sites that they're looking at. And our site is where they found a old Yellowstone, kind of a Yellowstone hot spring preserved for 3.7 billion years. Hmm. So we think if the rover goes there, it can roll up to the rock face and use a special chisel, which actually I'm designing right now.
Chisel to actually break rock?
Yeah, break rock like you do as a field geologist with a hammer. And look for these little fabric textures that indicate microbial biofilms. That's the oldest fossils we find on Earth. So we can find them on Earth in an old hot spring outcrop. We can possibly find them on Mars.
So you find an old hot spring on Mars, look for the remnants of a biofilm, and you can find that through chiseling a rock. Can't you do that with a laser? Just burn a hole in the rock and take a look at the vapor or something like that? Or
if you use a laser or, say, a drill or a rasp or something, you would destroy all that fine structure.
Really? So you have to literally break it?
You have to literally break it, and that's what every field geologist knows. And it turns out they don't have a chisel on the vehicles.
Oh.
Last night I did all the drawings and sent it to our team, and we're going to send it off to a robotics company and see if there's any chance we can get this thing built and demonstrated.
Hmm. And this would be on Mars by 2020?
Landing is 2021, actually, February, unless it's shifted. Sometimes these things shift.
Hmm. Wow. How big a team is looking for life on Mars?
It's big. It's the last meeting we were at, there were 300 people in the room. And then tomorrow, I'm flying to Texas, to Houston, Texas, you know, home of NASA Johnson Space Center, and meeting with hundreds of investigators in the origin of life, including graduate students and postdocs at the Galvez Hotel in Galveston. And that's a whole conference, and we'll be talking about Mars and all the new chemistry ideas. It's a very exciting time. I mean, this is certainly the most exciting time in my intellectual life.
What makes it most exciting for you, the fact that there's so many other bright minds out there exploring the stuff you're interested in?
You know, Alan, it's amazing because what started out as a simple visionary idea just 3-4 years ago has collected all these people around it. So it's like the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be part of what you would call a scientific revolution. Because it's not only the potential understanding of the origin of life, it's discovering an engine of creation, I call it. It's almost like a system that winds up and makes all of biology and even makes culture and technology. They're the same system with the same interacting part. So we're discovering something fundamental, kind of like when Copernicus discovered that the sun was the center of the solar system.
What's the fundamental thing here that you can...
that the pond is the source of all life.
Yeah, the jacuzzi, that the hot tub is...
The hot tub is the source of all life. There's people who've been suspecting that for a while, I think.
Well, they certainly have great ideas in the hot tubs. And maybe...
Well, you know, Dr. Future and I spent enormous amount of time in his hot tub on various mountaintops.
Yes, and probably
dreaming up the future.
It probably played a role in investigating hot tubs and the overall importance of things in the world.
Yeah. In answer to your question, Mrs. Future, it's that we've discovered that a cycling system that turns and allows things to get more complicated as it turns, like each pass it says, well, we'll grow a little bit more. And then in one of the parts of the pass, it tests those things that it's grown. And then it reproduces them and grows them again. And that's called the life cycle now. We call that the life cycle. But it also is the cycle of how technologies develop. You know, each cycle, a new smartphone comes out and it gets tested in the market. And it either grows or it doesn't. And tools go forward like smartphones. So it's really a common principle behind life and behind technology, culture, even consciousness itself.
Interesting that you're focusing on the cycle. For me, one of the parts of your theory that fascinates me the most is the idea that inside the pond, there wasn't just one life form that suddenly woke up one day and started learning to reproduce and eat and self-replicate and then mutating from there. It was actually a whole colony of different simultaneous experiments. And then that colony of experiments formed the first society, and the first society then started specializing into life.
Precisely right. You really nailed it, son. Our common ancestor was a community. It was a community of simple protocells that worked together in a kind of collaborative fashion, like a computer network almost. There was never actually a common ancestor. It was a common community. So there wasn't a couple of little simple protocells duking it out for dominance. That was impossible at the beginning because they didn't have the technologies to duke it out. To survive, they had to thrive together. They had to share products and congeal into a mass. The entire planet now could be seen in a sense as a progenote planet, as a mass of an aggregate of microbiomes, and where our bodies are, in fact, they're a big collaborative network, and so are our cities.
Yes, it's a principle that's expressed throughout biology.
And it's interesting to put it into words, too, because it's interesting you started out at the Galapagos Islands and talking about Darwin, who, of course, is known so much for the idea of survival of the fittest, and yet that's such a distortion of the true results of his research, because the insight here is that the environment is a complex and cooperating wholeness that operates in a way that brings all of the components to a new phase of evolution. It's so different than the idea of survival of the fittest and the idea that something eats something else and grows bigger and then the bigger one is the one that survives. It's just a whole different way of looking at it.
In fact, Sun, you've really hit the nail on the head in the survival of the fittest term, which was suggested by Spencer later on in Darwin's life, and he started using it. He wasn't really very satisfied with it. But that term has actually been the source of a lot of mischief over the years, from political economy to social Darwinism to dictatorships to eugenics to this and that. A lot of things have been done justified by this survival of the fittest.
Yes, it's been a narrative that has been internalized by many as being the way things are.
Yeah, and it's actually not correct. And if you operate from, say, separation or fear or fighting between groups, you end up being less survivable. Maybe you might gain temporary advantage, but you crash the whole system, which is what we're, in a sense, doing in, for the planet. We're crashing the system, the planetary system now.
Mm-hmm. Right, so and just to maybe put that in a simplified story, to be clear, if you think about the way that the story of, say, the European settlers coming to America and then dominating the Native Americans that were here, the idea was that somehow the guns and the culture of Europe was superior to the way that the natives were living and therefore became the way of the land. But in actuality, what was happening is that the natives were being deprived of their ecosystem where they knew how to survive, and they were being cornered into a smaller and smaller area where the ecosystem wasn't thriving and where they weren't using the kind of tactics that were being used outside of their ecosystem. And so that culture went away, and now that's in danger of happening on the whole planet, where the ecosystems are being denied and the life depending on those ecosystems is being suppressed and going away. And eventually the system that is kind of eating it until it's gone is going to collapse of its own weight because it doesn't have a better ecosystem. It's a predatory energy.
And perhaps this goes back to Dr. Future saying we need a new narrative. If we can get a new narrative going, and new myth or new story about how the world actually operates, and we can get it in time and we can get people to really realize that it's our survival and our thriving totally depends upon a cooperative model. And
so what do you, what
things that are,
So what narrative do you tell yourself about what's going on now, Bruce?
What I do is I look for stories of separation, sometimes it's called, and where a group pits itself against another group. And in a sense, fake news is this effort to create separation and create distrust. And every time you see that, you see a threat to viability of a society or an economic system. And so when you see those are, in a sense, they're the disease that could kill the body, whereas
right, the false belief. The false belief of not being connected to the whole.
Right, right. So people feel fearful, et cetera.
So, Bruce, we're going to have to go to our middle of the hour break.
Can you hold on for another segment?
Yeah.
All right. All
right. Sure can.
All right, talking to Dr. Bruce Damer. We'll be back after the news.
With the Dr. Future Show. Thanks for listening.
Hey, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer about origin of life research. And Bruce is about to go to a major conference in Houston where people in origin of life will all gather.
Galveston,
excuse me. We do have a question from the audience about how do you get a job doing this? And perhaps
you know, that's a good question. There isn't much funding for this work. So generally, it's chemists or physicists or mathematicians who have full labs and other jobs, or they've won Nobel Prizes or something, and they tend to take up the origin of life as part of their career. And there are some organizations that fund this work directly. NASA does, and Simons Foundation, and all those people. But there's very, very little funding. So I generally do other things, and
Yeah, so how do you, I guess people would like to know, how do you, as an indie scientist, keep it going?
You know, I've always had a philosophy since I was a kid of doing 6 or 7 things at once. Oh. So I have like 6 or 7 parallel careers. Mm-hmm. I design software, I do legal work, I do collections of vintage computers, I do speaking all around the world, I advise leaders and companies and things like this. So I put it all together. And it all just works out. Like the trip around the world in November was partly business, partly science, partly social.
Yeah, so some of the other projects, they take turns paying the bills, I guess. So
they take turns paying the bills, yeah.
Yeah, being a true Renaissance man, you follow the pulse of the things that interest you, and then they each do their part.
Yeah, I do follow that. I surf the waves, yeah.
Now, another interesting thing about the way that you disseminate the information, too, is that you are putting it out there with the scientists in the journals and that sort of thing, and that's absolutely what you're supposed to do when you're a scientist. But what's unique, I think, in your approach is that you're also trying to bring it out to the public more, and you're doing that not just through media, but also by going to festivals and talking to the kids about these things. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And you're thinking behind that.
Yeah, often a new scientific theory might take decades to work its way both through science and into the culture. Like relativity, theory of relativity probably took 25 years. And I think that things are sped up now, and we really need to, if there's an important message or discovery as it's being tested, it should be actually discussed in the public. So we were all at the Eclipse Festival in Oregon, and part of watching that wonderful event there was I did a talk on Origin of Life, and we had, 200-300 people there. And it was amazing because that's 25-year-olds, 32-year-olds, young people coming to these massive festivals like Burning Man. And that's where you can reach a whole generation of very, very smart, motivated people.
What do you hope to get across to them?
I think that there's a new narrative that there's something new in science that's very exciting. So some of them actually have come to work in our lab on campus doing chemistry. Some of them have come to develop math and stuff. So they've actually directly worked on this. And I think the other part is I think it gives people hope. It gives them a perspective just beyond the here and now, their daily challenges or the kind of noisy news feed now, mostly fake news, that there is a more beautiful world that's out there, that we are created by this incredible process and we're very, very rare and special, and that we should actually really appreciate and be grateful for our lives, our existence in the universe.
Right. Yeah, that's much better narrative than the last few hundred years where we all have original sin and we should be punishing ourselves and each other because we'll never be good enough.
Yeah, I had to claw my way to the top.
Yeah, who created that one? You know, those are unproductive narratives. Yeah. They get people working, but
those narratives are for people who want to dominate other people by disempowering them through their beliefs.
You don't know how many times I've been out talking to businessmen who say, I haven't seen you out in the trenches for a while. Where have you been? You know, using war metaphors for understanding business. And that's more common than not. Very fascinating. Look at this.
We're caught in a sea of metaphors and narratives, and many of them do not serve us well. And I think that young people really know this more than our generation. It's funny because a young friend of mine who has an 8-year-old son, and the 8-year-old son said, as far as he can tell, all news reporting is fake. Like network news reporting, it's all spun. And he prefers just to talk to people who are actually in those countries and ask them what's going on. He doesn't believe anything. He doesn't believe any corporate reporting or individual.
Well, I believe that's the good that comes out of when it's such a common practice for people to tell lies to promote their own beliefs. Then the result is that people value their own opinions more than the opinions of those they hear. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, do you think there are any principles in biology that might be applied to culture by making decisions, like the way bacteria make decisions, applying to the way we run politics?
Right? Yeah, Bruce, you gave us a term that polling has entered our vocabulary quite a bit from the bacteria world, which is quorum sensing.
Quorum sensing, for example. Tell us what quorum sensing is.
Yeah, if there's sort of a colony of bacteria that they work not as individuals competing against each other, but as a group, as a quorum. So they sense their environment. And if there's a lot of food, they'll change their chemistry and they give each other jobs. Like if there's a lot of food, now it's time to reproduce. If there's less food, some of the bacteria sort of commit hari-kari and kill themselves off, and because it benefits the whole colony. Because the whole point is that the colony or the genes of the colony survive tough times.
So there is a colony, the good of the many is greater than the good of the one.
Yeah, and that's how we work too, in societies that succeed, and our bodies. You know, our spleen doesn't tell our liver, I'm not going to work with you today because you said something I didn't like. You know, everything is working in incredible synchrony to allow us to actually live for 90 years. And you can imagine what has to happen for us to live even for a few years, but for almost a century.
Yeah. And perhaps those principles apply on the more complex cognitive creations of our own governments and companies, corporations and such. We can learn a lot from our biology in how we do business with each other.
Yeah, it's absolutely our nature, and our biology is our best teacher. I think it's better than any Harvard Business School paper or any leader's proclamation, is how nature actually does something.
Well, how does nature make the news? It seems like nature is just going about her business, invisible as usual, until some crisis occurs. But how do we actually get our focus to be just on day-to-day nature so that we're in harmony?
That's a real challenge. If you live in a 50-story apartment building in Shanghai, which is where I was, you don't have much connection with nature at all. The nearest park might be 30 minutes away by train. So how do people have a connection? So this is a major challenge for humanity, because if we become absolutely disconnected from nature, then we cannot take care of our world, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of the listeners have ideas there. I mean, we live in a beautiful natural environment here in Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay.
That's true. You know, that's true.
It's all around us, but for most people, they don't have access and they don't have a personal connection.
Well, let's quantify. We're talking about when people are living in urban areas, they don't have access to nature. And that actually reminds me that in the past, my understanding is that Native people actually had a tribal awareness of their impact on the environment, and they never allowed themselves to settle into a community that was more than, say, 20 or 30,000 people, because that was the maximum amount of footprint that could actually sustainably live inside of a natural environment. We have some people, some academics think that way when they talk about it being a one-world planet or a five-world planet, depending on your standard of living. But we're divorced from that at the level of talking to each other on a day-to-day basis of how can 40,000 people make sure that this grocery market stays stocked with the food that we all need. We're not having that conversation.
Yeah, and son, what's interesting is that in academia now, they're talking about when they look at the actual health patterns, there's some belief now that the invention of agriculture was actually a major disaster for humanity instead of sort of the boon, because health and the health and life of individuals in a hunter-gatherer community was much better than the health and daily life of people in the early agricultural world, where you basically had kings taking over and controlling grain supplies, and actually people's lifespans dropped a lot because of the amount of labor and the problems with diet and the problems that were introduced by agriculture and then living in crowded, disease-ridden environments. So for a period of 7,000 or 8,000 years, during the agricultural period, people's quality of life was actually much worse. And in some ways, we struggled out of that through science and technology in the last 300 years. But yeah.
Well, let's continue that conversation. Very interesting, after the break. And then we also have a few callers lining up. We're talking with Bruce Damer.
Give us a call at 479-1080 if you have a question for Dr. Damer.
And we're going to go to a break.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer, and we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. We want to say hi to Tom from Watsonville. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom.
Hello. I'm going to switch to my iPhone. seriously. Can you hear me better?
Yeah,
yes,
that's good.
Much.
Yeah. Okay, good. So my point was, or my thought is, that you kind of ridicule the idea of original sin, but I don't think you really understand what it is, and it really explains the world's in a mess. You said that yourself. We've screwed things up, and that started when man refused by his own free will to live within the context of the perfection of the system, right? And what the Garden of Eden, right?
Okay, well, actually, I guess you're saying that I'm contradicting myself, that the original sin is the idea of poisoning your environment.
Exactly, and that the sin of mistreating one another has an effect that goes way beyond just the human relations, that it, in fact, poisoned everything that is. And everything's so connected that mistreatment of one human to another poisoned everything.
Okay.
And that's original sin. It's the state of living in a place that was a creation that was completely poisoned. I guess it's an allegory to this system that you're talking about there, where everything is cooperative and gets along and serves purpose. Everybody gets along together, and everything that is cooperates in one system, but
okay,
that's broken.
Okay, Tom, thanks. I want to direct this question to our guest, Bruce.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. So, Bruce, do you want to talk about something along these lines of honoring our nature and nature?
Yeah, I think it's clear that we couldn't exist here without plants growing, animals eating the plants, et cetera, et cetera.
And we may in our lifetime find that the planet is too small for us to grow plants the way that we have been in the past.
And civilizations in the past have crashed. I mean, we look at Easter Island, we look at Iraq and what was sort of the ancient civilizations of the Indus Valley and whatnot. And those civilizations crashed out their environment. They salinized the soil, they caused massive erosional problems, and they literally had to leave. So in a sense, we don't have anywhere to go. Space development's not that far along, so we're not going to another world. So we have to take care of our garden. We really have to do that, or we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to be stuck.
Mm, great. All right, Tom, thanks for that call.
Thanks.
We've got a few more folks. Okay, bye.
Thanks.
All right. Now we're going to say hi to Judy in Santa Cruz. Hi, Judy.
I just want to say, personally, I think I was born in original bliss, but anyway.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Hi, Judy.
Hey. Oh, gosh, I'm out of breath. This has been a tremendous show, and I wanted to call earlier, but I'm still getting over the flu. So, but then when that caller just called to explain original sin, I thought I should call because I'm very excited about the fact that the whole... Okay, if he's going to say that, is he going to say there's a physical hell? Because there's no hell.
You guys, can
either.
We not
and
have this conversation on this show?
No, we're born with a spark of life.
Yeah.
It's not about religion. I'm trying to dognate that. I had a thought when I woke up a couple years ago one morning. I just want to pass it out. It was ether, the final frontier. And I've really been pulling that into my life as becoming more of a sovereign being, knowing that I am an eternal being.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are all eternal beings. Anyway, I shouldn't preach, but this is what I find within me.
Okay.
And Bruce, you're awesome. You're the one that saved Dr. Pierre's film. I'd love to talk to you about that sometime. The Summer of Love movie. That's how I first found Bruce. So gosh darn it, thank you so much for your work, Bruce, and I'll let other people call. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks, Judy.
No, thank you.
So what's the Summer of Love project, Bruce? What was that?
Oh, we found some old films that we digitized from that era 50 years ago, and I put them online, and a lot of people have found them. A different time in history, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A different feeling, a different sense of destiny.
Well, in a sense, the hippie explosion or eruption in those 2 years of like 1965, 67, 68, there was this sense, and son, of course, you lived in one of the environments in the Haight-Ashbury. There was a sense that through a new form of communal living and society that we could actually make better lives collectively. And that actually flowed into the society to some degree, but that was an opening in the Western world for new thinking about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to use the word culture sculpture as opposed to some other way of describing the open-mindedness that all young people have, that they can reinvent the world they're in to their own liking, to their own priorities. And I think that's always true, and it's always been true.
So, Bruce, you also were speaking at the Conference of Non-Duality. What was that all about?
Yeah, so with this new model for the origin of life, there's interest in different communities, and one of them was this consciousness research community and this conference called Science and Non-Duality in San Jose in October. And it was a combination of neurobiologists, physicists, and non-dual teachers and meditators. And I don't know a whole lot about non-duality, but these are people that are very curious. And so I did a 20-minute talk, which we're actually editing down today, where I took them from sort of the mechanistic start of life all the way up through perhaps an explanation for what consciousness actually is and what intention does to shape the future. You're the Dr. Future Show. You look forward into the future, and I predict that as you have a strong intention for things, you actually shape the probability and bring those things toward you, and it may be one of the best tools we have as beings.
So do you really think that we as individuals have that much of an influence on the collective?
I think that we're tied together into sort of an internetwork, and that when we send out a server request on the internet, a bunch of things happen and we buy something on Amazon. But I think when we have a strong intention and we sort of shape our lives around it, it's like a server request into this kind of etheric internet, and then coincidences start to line up in front of us. And if we take them, it just potentiates some beautiful event. And it's happened in my life over and over again. I think it's happened in listeners' lives, too.
Where you find yourself in the zone, so to speak, in a nice flow.
Nice flow, exactly. Things are just coming one after the other after the other.
Yeah, and that's the desired state to be in. And the synchronicities are a sign that you're on course with that. Yeah,
exactly. You get those signs that you're on course, exactly, Alan, exactly.
Yeah. Another thing that I think would be fun to share with the audience is last Friday, we went to the Internet Archive, and that's an interesting phenomenon, you know, that the whole idea, because it's certainly not the way to make a lot of money in our society, but the Internet Archive represents an idea that preserves some of the ideas of collaboration on a massive scale.
And
it's the idea that we could back up the Internet, for one thing. It seems almost audacious at this point. But it has evolved as the archive to not just backing up the internet, which they do, but also to preserve old records. I think they have a big 78 RPM project right now going on, going back in time to collect the history of the species. And it's a strong drive. Kind of curious, what's your involvement with the archive or yourself at this point?
Well, I'm an archives junkie, so between the DigiBarn Computer Museum and the Timothy Leary Archives and whatnot, I've built all these collections. And I digitized and put all this stuff up, and now we're going to do Dr. Future's video collection and the Dr. Future Show. By putting them up there, they're preserved for a longer period of time than individual servers or YouTube would do.
Yeah,
and people can link everything together. They can find everything by Dr. Future and say, hey, I'm going to listen to everything, but I'm going to also look at his videos. So Dr. Future becomes a personality in cyberspace.
Hmm. So you can do that with archive.org resources, and they're pretty much for free, right?
Yeah. It's free storage, and it's supported by the public and by grants and things like that. So it's a tremendous asset.
I think I just saw on the news or on the website that they were gifted with $1 million worth of Bitcoin in the last week.
Yes. That's why Brewster Kahle, the founder, was so happy when we were up there. They came off a wonderful new year, you know.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So you want to check that out, folks. Go to archive.org, archive.org. It's a fascinating site with millions of sound records, video, text files, people's personal collections, you name it. Bruce,
and every website, every month until from 1997.
That's right. So you look at your website 10 years ago and you can see what it looked like, or 20 years ago at this point. And I think they said something like the entire internet was only like 4 terabytes back in 96?
Two terabytes.
Two terabytes?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
2 terabytes. The whole web was 2 terabytes.
Isn't that amazing? So with the last few seconds here, how can we find out more about you, Bruce? What's the best place to go?
It's all at damer.com, D-A-M-E-R.com, and you'll hear all the live reports at levityzone.org.
Levityzone.org. That's your podcast. Right. And we've done some podcasts there ourselves, Bruce and I, that you might enjoy.
Tubcast, yep.
Tubcast, right. Yes. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for listening. Thank you, Bruce, for being our guest. And we look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
All right. See you next week on Dr.